might be turning in your Bibles, if you're not still there, back to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18. It is certainly good to see everyone out this morning. And yet, as has been acknowledged so clearly several times, we are heavy in heart for those who can't be with us this morning, prevented because of the COVID situation. And it is our heartfelt desire that we will all be able to be back together again very soon, and so that we can fully, this morning, we can enjoy the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. But won't it be wonderful when we can do that all together again freely, as we do that in one place in worshiping God together? Well, in Matthew chapter 18, Jesus teaches us several powerful lessons. And I think, Gable, thank you so much. The song you just led really is an encapsulation of this lesson. And the sentiments there, it forms a better summary than I think I can, given 20 or 30 minutes. It's just a tremendously good song for this lesson. So thank you. But here Jesus teaches some lessons that are just absolutely essential for us to grasp as children of God as we work together. And their lessons are not complicated. They're really rather simple. But that does not mean that they're not challenging. They're very challenging. And I think the reason is because they hit right at the heart of who we are. Our motives, our intents, how we think about ourselves, how we think about others. It gets down into our habits of thought. And those are things that they're not easily moved. It takes quite a bit of effort on our part to change those things. It takes a lot of determination. So in this chapter, and we won't look at all of it, we'll just select a few things from it to highlight. Jesus really destroys the idea that we can in any way maintain a prideful, a self-seeking, or an unmerciful heart and have any hope at all of being with God and seeing God and being accepted by Him. And when you think about that, that makes the seriousness of it very profound. I mean, these are very basic concepts, but yet they're profound and critical. He makes it clear that in order to be pleasing to God, we're going to have to cultivate that humble, that compassionate, and that merciful and forgiving spirit that he so clearly himself manifested. And that's why the song, I think, was so good. Oh, to be like that. When it's all said and done, that is the goal, because he manifested it so perfectly. But turning our attention back to Matthew chapter 18, but look here at verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And the question really isn't stunning that they would ask that. When you think about their background, they had been steeped in the pomp and circumstance and the hierarchy of the scribes and the Pharisees, the Sadducees in particular. So that part doesn't really surprise us that that mindset would be present among the Jews. And when you think about their concept of the Messiah, what's he going to do? He's going to return to the earth to set up this kingdom that will not only rival Solomon's, but even exceed it. So that they would be as close to Jesus with that as they are with that mindset, that they would ask this question isn't stunning, except for one key factor. It's when they asked it. If they had asked it very early in their exposure to Jesus, then perhaps that makes sense. They're learning, they're growing, but they've been with him for 2 years now. And as stunning as it is here in Matthew 18, it's even more bewildering when we look at it in Luke chapter 22. Flip over there for just a second, if you would. In Luke chapter 22, it defies reason that they could be thinking about these things at this time. Verse 24. "Now there was also a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. And he said to them, 'The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, And those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors. But not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger. And he who governs as he who serves. We'll stop there. But this, when you look at the context, is the very evening before the betrayal of Jesus. He's just instituted the Lord's Supper. Even back in Matthew chapter 18, if you look back in chapter 17, verses 22 and 23, what we see there is he's instituting, or he's teaching them about his impending death, his betrayal, the fact that he's going to be taken and put into the hands of lawless men and killed, and the resurrection. So those very weighty, the context is those very weighty teaching, and yet their minds are on greatness. And then as we see, even though Jesus deals with this so powerfully right here, later on they're still going to be dealing with it. So, and what that highlights for us is that the things we're talking about here, that self-seeking, the pride, the conceit, it's so insidious. I mean, it slips in to our thinking so effortlessly. We tend to allow it into our hearts without thinking. It's there and it sets up shop and becomes very, very difficult to dislodge. And so Jesus taught on this a lot, and he gave such a powerful illustration of the antidote in his own life and his own attitudes. And so that's what we're looking at this morning. I don't know what the disciples thought. I don't know what they expected him to say. But I'm pretty sure it wasn't what came next. So Jesus, in verse 2 of Matthew 18, Jesus called a little child to him, set him in the midst of them, and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me." You think about the scene. They've got these visions of grandeur. They have themselves said just a few chapters earlier, "You are the Christ. You are the Son of the living God." They know this. They know he's setting up a kingdom. He said so. They want that place of preeminence among the leaders of that kingdom. Whatever their concept was, that's where they wanted to be. Jesus hears this question and he says, he looks, and here's a child perhaps playing in the dirt. "Little one, come." So the child dutifully obeys and comes, and Jesus puts this child in the midst of these disciples. They're looking on. Jesus is about to instruct them. But here's this very powerful object lesson right there with them. This little child, maybe hair messed up, a little dirt on the face. Just a beautiful picture of innocence. And so Jesus highlights some things about this child that are very powerful. You know, when we think about children, they don't occupy a place of power and prestige. They're humble by default because of they're dependent. They are not sophisticated. They're not powerful. They don't control their own lives. And most of them recognize that. And yet, here we see this child put in their midst of these people who very much want to be the opposite of that. And Jesus is going to make that very clear. When you think about a child, that simplicity, that purity, they're so transparent. Even when they, you know, they're not sophisticated. Even when they're trying not to be, they just really can't pull it off. A little child can. I recall I had many years ago now, I came in from work one day, and Kathy had been keeping our niece all day, and she was going to trick me. So I walked in and she said, "Guess what, Uncle Greg? We've got a surprise for you, and it's not a pie." Well, of course it was. That was her way of really tricking me. So the point being, they're transparent and beautifully so. But the thing that Jesus is highlighting about this child isn't even those things. It's the humility. He's pointing to the fact that this is what you need to be. You won't enter the kingdom of heaven unless you humble yourself and become as this little child. Wow, that's powerful. That's the exact opposite of what they had in mind. So why then does he transition to this warning about offenses in verse 6? It says there, whoever causes these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a millstone were hung around his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. Woe to the world because of offenses, for offenses must come, but woe to that man by whom the offense comes. Why would he transition to that thought immediately? I think the key to this is when we think about if we unpack what it takes for us to get to those offenses. What is the source really when we think about those offenses? Where do they come from? What do they grow out of? Well, is it not from hearts that are self-seeking, that are prideful, that look down on others and seek to elevate themselves above others? That isn't that where the vast majority of strife and conflict and malice come? And so, of course, it's very natural for Jesus to transition to a discussion about offenses. And not just a discussion about them. He's pointing out the very grave nature of them. Could he use more powerful language? Could he use a more graphic illustration to make this point to us? Think about what it would be like. I mean, really put yourself there. You're out on the sea. Someone has taken a great millstone, huge, heavy, weighs hundreds and hundreds of pounds, tied it around your neck. Now it's going to summarily cast you and the millstone overboard. You are doomed to a horrible death. Jesus didn't choose that arbitrarily. He chose it to illustrate offenses. You may make light of them. I mean, isn't that what we tend to do? If I have harmed you, I tend to minimize that harm. I tend to minimize the impact to you, to your spirit, to your motivation to serve the Lord. I tend to minimize the impact that it has on how you feel about being a Christian, about your service to God. So I minimize them. Jesus says, no, not so fast. You need to understand this for what it is. It would be better for you to have a millstone tied to your neck and thrown into the sea. That would be far better than to offend one of your brethren. Don't take it lightly. This is serious business. And I think Jesus teaches, I mean, he's so gentle in the way that he teaches, and yet he pulls no punches. He's making it very clear. You can't have it that way. When you think about, you know, we're studying the book of Romans. We're in chapter 14. The wording that's used there. You think about chapter 14, verse 15. Do not destroy with your food the one for whom Christ died. Now you think about that. This is as Stephen, I'm sure, will point out very clearly, these are matters of opinion, of scruples. We're not talking about doctrine here. We're talking about things that people may or may not do. And Paul is teaching there through the Holy Spirit, you can destroy your brother with food. That would be an offense. You can destroy your brother by the things you eat. You can, and think about this. We just observed the Lord's Supper. And Lance read Psalm 22. We see all that is involved. Just so powerful. The what Jesus had to go through. The determination, the suffering. I can essentially undo that. I can set that at naught as respect to this brother by the things that I do. I can place a stumbling block in front of my brother that will, if it takes the course that Satan wants it to, will nullify what Jesus did in going to the cross on behalf of this brother. I can destroy his soul. Now look, he's got a choice in the matter. We know that. But I'm contributing. And Jesus is making it perfectly clear, you will not be held innocent in this situation. God will not hold you innocent. Well, then he transitions, and we're skipping down here to verse 10, to God's concern and his compassion for the lost one. And he's still using the context of a little one. And now he's already qualified. This is a little one who believes in him. He's now made it clear. He's talking about disciples. He's talking about us. Take heed that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I say to you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. For the Son of Man has not come, or rather has come, to save that which was lost. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them goes astray, does he not leave the 99 and go to the mountains and seek the one that is straying? And if he should find it, assuredly I say to you, he rejoices more over that sheep than over the 99 that did not go astray. Even so, it is not the will of your Father, who is in heaven, that one of these little ones should perish. So this is an extension of that thought. Pride, selfishness, conceit, these things cause us to look at others as less important than ourselves. We look on that one as not so important. But what he's saying here in no uncertain terms is, to God, none, not one, the humblest, the least among us is exceptionally important to God. Again, using the illustration that is most powerful of all that have ever been, Jesus went to the cross for that one, for each one, for me, for you, for all. And so we should never have that mindset toward the lost that it's inconsequential when one goes astray. So tying that back to the offenses, how crucial that I maintain a humble attitude of service and compassion toward my brother so that I don't put him in that position to go away. Better to remain in the fold than to go astray. And God, he makes it clear he's not willing, 2 Peter 3:9, that any should perish, but that all come to repentance. He wants everyone. Our minds are drawn back to Luke chapter 15, where Jesus is at pains to straighten out the thinking, primarily of the disciples, but also in the context, he's talking to the Pharisees there, of that idea that these unwashed, they don't matter. They're not worthy to be considered spiritually important. He uses those three illustrations, the sheep, the coin, and the lost son, to illustrate how God feels about them, but more importantly, how we should feel about those who've gone astray. Well, then we skip down here to the context of Matthew 18, verses 21 through 22. And here, Peter's been listening. And you can almost think from Peter, I mean, we know a fair amount about how Peter reacts to things and how he processes things and how sometimes he doesn't process things. And we can relate to it. At least I know I can. I think a lot of us can. So he's picked it up. He's got it. Jesus is making this point clear. So he says, how many times should I forgive my brother? Jesus has just been talking about reconciliation. How many times should I forgive my brother? Well, Jewish law, the Talmud, points out three times. This is your obligation. Beyond that, nothing more is required of you. So Peter, probably aware of that, says, well, up to seven times? And so probably thinking himself pretty generous right about now. He's taken what the Jews would typically say. He's doubled it. And then he's added one for good measure, 7 times. Surely that's good. But no, Jesus comes back and says, not 7 times, but 70 times 7. Peter's mindset is one of, you know, forgiveness is something that I probably ought to do. I mean, God is forgiving after all, and so we ought to do that. And so I'm going to extend this. It's a right of mine to have something against my brother, but I'm going to forego that. I'm going to extend forgiveness. I'm going to do that once, twice, however many times. But then I can pull that right back. I can shut it down, as it were. Jesus says you never, ever, ever have the right to shut that down. You never have the right to say no more. So he's making it clear that there's no opportunity for us to hold on to any grievance. And certainly we need to develop the habit of being willing, the disposition and the habit of being willing to forgive quickly and then doing it. Well, he gives this illustration. He goes straight into it here, beginning in verse 23, that really has so many shocking things in it as we go through it. There are things in there that just beg credulity. It's just the magnitude of the debt, the magnitude of the compassion that we're about to look at is just amazing. Verse 23 says, therefore the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. And when he had begun to settle accounts, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. And as he was not able to pay, his master commanded that he be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and that payment be made. The servant therefore fell down before him, saying, Master, have patience with me, and I will repay you all. Then the master of that servant was moved with compassion, released him, and forgave the debt. Forgave him the debt. But that servant went out, found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii, and he laid hands on him and took him by the throat, saying, pay me what you owe. This fellow servant fell down at his feet and begged him, saying, have patience with me and I will pay you all. And he would not, but he went, threw him into prison till he should pay the debt. So when his fellow servants saw what had been done, they were very grieved. And they came and told their master all that had been done. Then his master, after he had called him, said to him, you wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you begged me. Should you not also have compassion on your fellow servant, just as I had pity on you? And his master was angry and delivered into the torturers until he should pay all that was due him. So my heavenly Father will also do if each of you from his heart does not forgive his brother his trespasses from his heart. This parable has been broken into 3 scenes by others. And as we look at these scenes, we just marvel at the concepts that Jesus is teaching here. We marvel at the audacity of this servant on a number of occasions here. We'll take a look at that. The king decides that it's time to settle accounts with his servant. So he once brought to him who owes this 10,000 talents. Now, to set that in context, you know, we're not going to convert it to millions. It's a lot of millions, okay? But put it in its historical context. Earnhardt talks about what Josephus points out in his Antiquities. Galilee and Perea together annually owed Rome 200 talents worth of taxes. You put that together with the whole region, Judea, all of it, Idumea, the whole 800 talents a year. So now you think about this. This is more than 12 times as much. the whole region. So one of the things that begs credulity, which we don't focus on too much, is how did this fella get that, his hands on that money, the opportunity to lose that much money? But the point really is that Jesus is making, it's unpayable. And look, it's not an amount of money. The king is not so rich that it doesn't matter to him. The king will pay, he will suffer for this loss. This is a king's ransom. This is money that even the king feels. He is not indifferent. When he forgives him, it's not as though he doesn't care. It's not 100 denarii. Well, think then of his sentence. The servant is condemned to prison, but it's not just that, it's his wife and his children are condemned to prison. Think about that. As a husband, as a father, the horror of the realization that not only will you have no opportunity to care for, to protect your wife and children, but they're going to share the same fate as you. And so it's no surprise that he begs vehemently for forgiveness. He doesn't really beg for forgiveness. He begs for time to save, to actually pay it back. And that is audacious. We've already quantified the scope of this debt. He's not going to pay it back. A thousand lifetimes he couldn't pay it back. And yet here he is. I'll repay all. Well, he didn't have much of an opportunity to do that. But the really shocking thing is that the king is moved with compassion toward this servant who has lost him this immense amount of money. And he forgives him, sets him free. But he does not set him free to go work it off. As I said, he forgave the debt not owed. When this man walks out, not only is his wife and his children and his goods, not only are all those things intact, and now he's in a position to care for them, he doesn't owe the king anything. He is truly scot-free. That brings us to the second scene. He goes out, and with a heart that should be absolutely free, should be full of joy, should be so grateful, he instead goes out and he looks for his fellow servant who owes him that 100 denarii. Now look, it's not a tiny amount of money, but it is not even comparable to what he had just been forgiven. But notice, before he even knows anything, he's got his fellow servant by the throat. You see that attitude. Pay me my money. I don't have it. Pay me my money. I don't have it. But if you'll be patient with me, I'll repay you all. Jesus did not choose those words arbitrarily. He put the words in the mouth of that servant, the fellow servant who owed the 100 denarii. The exact words that this man had used. But he wouldn't have it. Instead, he says, no, there will be no mercy for you. There will only be justice. And so he has this man who owes him this money thrown into prison until he should pay all of this debt. Well, he didn't escape notice when he did this. The fellow servants saw this, and they were grieved in their hearts that this man who had been forgiven such an enormous thing, an enormous debt, could have such a callous and uncaring and uncompassionate heart. And so they told the king, and the king is not indifferent. He is very angry, wrathful. He is going to make sure that this situation is righted. And so he has this servant drug back before him again. And this time he says to him, "You wicked, wicked servant." Not because he lost 10,000 talents. That's not why he calls him wicked. He explains why he calls him wicked. because I forgave you all that debt, that tremendous debt, I forgave you, and yet you are not willing to forgive your brother, even a small debt. You are truly wicked. Well, now, Jesus doesn't tell us this story so that we can look and see how ridiculous and foolish this man looks. He tells us this story so we can look at ourselves and see how ridiculous and foolish we look to God. When we, having been forgiven a king's ransom, as it were, in sin, a debt so unimaginably great that we have offended the God of heaven, our Creator, and have nothing to pay. And yet, we can hold a grudge. We can hold an offense against a brother. We don't have that right. And we certainly don't have the right to feel that God's indifferent about it. He is not. That king represents how God looks at that. That is a wicked, wicked thing to our God. You think about what someone may do to me. There is absolutely no comparison. Any wrong or harm done me, or that I may do, pales in comparison to the harm, the wrong that we have done to our God and Father. So when we balk or hesitate at forgiving someone else, we do it from a position of having wronged others many times ourselves. When God forgives us, who'd He wrong? Never did. Never wronged anyone. So our righteous God is setting an example. Look, I don't have this problem. I do not wrong people. I only do good. And yet, I am willing to forgive. How much more you, when you have a brother who does what you've only done? He only does what you've done. Forgive him. Do not hold that in your heart. Don't allow this to become an opportunity for Satan to build up resentment, malice, discontent, conflict. Paul, through the Spirit, talks about those things many times in the epistles. Beware. Walk circumspectly. Look out for these things. Satan is setting that trap for you over and over again. Where does it start? It starts in our heart. And these things are intractable, difficult things for us to solve. Difficult for us to, sometimes even to recognize, but then once we do recognize it, to fix it. But Jesus has given us all the tools we need. He's illustrating it so clearly and beautifully for us that we can see what we need to do. We can see the gravity of the situation, the crucial nature of it, and we can work on it. Well, finally, turn over here to Colossians chapter 3. We'll read just a couple of verses here that I think encapsulate the other side of this, that talk about what our attitudes should be. Colossians chapter 3, and beginning in verse 12. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, and long-suffering, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. Now look, there may be those among us, and I'm confident there are those among us who are doing a wonderful, wonderful job at this. I know myself, sometimes I don't. And it's a struggle that we have to maintain humility, because pride and those things slip in so effortlessly, as I mentioned earlier. They're insidious, these attitudes. And once you have them stamped out, you can't just assume that you're never going to have to deal with it again. The next thing you know, they'll creep right back into your thoughts without much effort. But if you do have, like I do sometimes, struggle with these things, please consider Jesus' teaching here that we've looked at this morning. Please humble yourself and develop that contrite, humble heart. Not only toward yourself, but also in view of others. Consider others better and not lesser. That's what Jesus is calling us to do. And as he points out in verse 35 in Matthew chapter 18, we don't need to at any point in time delude ourselves into thinking this is optional. It is absolutely not. Jesus already made the point, you don't humble yourself like this child, you won't go into the kingdom of heaven. Here in verse 35, he closes that up by saying, so my Father also will do to you if each of you from his heart does not forgive his brother his trespasses. So that humility, that compassion, that forgiveness, very simple lessons, very simple, very difficult, very challenging. Let's make sure that we're working on it. Well, God sent his Son in great compassion and mercy for us, as we've alluded to and said outright several times. He came to seek and to save the lost. So the question is this morning, are you among the lost? He's not willing that any should perish. Are you willing to perish? Worse yet, are you willing yourself to perish, to be destroyed, to be cast out, to be in the position of that wicked servant, someone who does not have that humility, compassion, that love for the brother? Are you someone who has never submitted to the gospel? You have that opportunity now. Please have the humility to humble yourself in submission to God. And please do that right now while together we stand and sing.